I found some things and looking over some old magazines today that I thought she might be interested in hearing. Sister Yanamata, as you know, was Master Chief Woman Disciple. And I had the very great privilege of knowing her intimately. She was the wife of Professor Bishop here, who was professor of law at the University of Washington for a good many years. And at the time he was there, the president in charge of the university, his name was Spencer. And he made the statement that she had the most brilliant mind of any woman he'd ever come in contact with. Yet this highly intelligent woman chose to give up everything in her personal life and the life of the world, and finally when she had met the Master, to go and be with him. And I can truthfully say that of all the disciples that I have ever met, she was the perfect one. Every time you would see her anywhere around Master, you would never see her with her back turned to him, but always, no matter how many people were around him, she was always facing him. She felt that it was disrespectful to turn her back on the Guru. She lived the life of a renunciate truly. Many of the times she did without food in the early days when Master didn't have too much to give to the disciples in order that someone else might be fed. And one time she had starved her body. She lived just on tea to the point where she was very, very ill. So Master had the doctor in. The doctor was trying to diagnose her case. The Master went inside and realized all of a sudden what she had done and accused her of it, and she said, yes, she had. I will tell you another thing about her that I knew to be the truth. There was one time when she was wringing some clothes, and at that time they didn't have the dryers as we have them now, but they had the wringers that you did more or less by hand. She got her hand caught in this wringer, and every bone in the hand was crushed. So she was rushed to the hospital, they x-rayed, and it was said that she had to have the hand amputated. And she refused to do this. And she went back to Master, and she said to him, sir, I have complete faith in your power to put my hand back in the perfect condition that it was, and I am not going to have it amputated. And he said, sister, you ask almost the impossible of me. And she said to him, to God in you, all things are possible, I know. So by some ancient yogic method, he had studied tantric yoga, which is the yoga of powers. He set every bone in her hand, and later when it was x-rayed again, they couldn't find the situation that had at first developed at all, and they were utterly confounded to think that any human being, so-called human, could perform such a wonderful feat. I had the privilege of visiting her home many, many times, of being intimately associated with her, so I know what this woman was, and she was indeed great. For some time, there appeared in the magazines an article entitled A Letter from a Disciple. This was after she had left the body. Dear one, if I could, I would like to engrave upon the heart of the disciple two basic truths. First, you can only have your own, and your own will surely come to you. Indeed, you cannot escape it. The other is that the Guru is always the Guru in every act and utterance, even if he is not consciously acting as such. In our hearts, perhaps subconsciously, we really prefer what our karma gives us to that which another receives, knowing that it is what we need. For the disciple to permit the thought that he is being unfairly treated to enter his mind is fatal. The will of God flows to the disciple through the Guru at all times. If we accept our discipline in the right spirit, it will strengthen our character as nothing else could. With love always, Yanamata. And this is another one. Dear one, I want to finish my talk this way because it is not likely that I will have a chance alone with you. Besides, I do not want to discuss personalities, but to lay down some principles that I know will help you, for they are true, basic, timeless. First, the meeting with the Guru is not for pleasure. It is a hand-to-hand conflict between his God-conscious soul and the newly awakening soul of the disciple. Second, a master does not care whether you suffer or not, whether your feelings are hurt or not, because he knows that when his work for your soul is accomplished, all suffering will be over for you. One night at dinner not long ago, our guru said, all suffering is from Satan. It was some time before I got the meaning, though it is obvious. The God-realized soul has the power to rise above suffering. Third, your feelings were hurt? What of it? Resolve that for you will dawn the day of absolute liberation from all petty feelings. Fourth, do you remember my telling you that when I first came to the center, I determined that whatever happened, I would not be daunted nor ask explanations? I would try to see eye to eye with the guru. The result has justified the experiment, and not long ago he praised me because he has never had to explain anything to me. Fifth, make a few simple rules for yourself. If the guru seems to be displeased with you, ask him to show you wherein you were wrong, if you do not already know, that you may improve. If you wish to explain yourself, do so, for he always welcomes explanations. But do it respectfully, with sincerity that cannot be mistaken, and with humility. Now, what does that word humility mean? Nothing worm-like nor groveling. It means the simple, straightforward admission that you are not perfect, and that you know you get nothing in the way of blame or discipline that you do not deserve. Never stay away from him as you have done. If you get only suffering, come just the same. Remember how the saint kept coming when his guru to test him would not speak to him. Sixth, quoting from Gibran, when love beckons to you, follow him, though his ways are hard and steep. And when his wings enfold you, yield to him, though the sword hidden among his pinions may wound you. And when he speaks to you, believe on him, though his words may shatter your dreams as the north wind lays waste the garden. Dear one, the above is just the experience you are having. Please do not throw this letter away, even if you do not like or understand it. Keep it until you do. And another. And then I came across something which perhaps all of you have heard at one time of your life, or one time or another of your life in school. But it's a tremendous poem, and it was written by Rudyard Kipling, entitled If. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise, if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you have spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stupid build them up with worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and, which is more, you will be a man, my son. And that, of course, applies to women, too. That says everything. If we could do all of those things, we would have nothing to worry about. My subject tonight is Let Go and Let God. And in connection with this, I'd like to read to you from Romans chapter 8, beginning with verse 16. The Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who has subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? But if we hope for that we see not, then do we with patience wait for it. Likewise the Spirit also helpeth our infirmity, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought. But the Spirit itself maketh intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. And he that searcheth the heart knoweth what is the mind of the Spirit, because he maketh intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. Now we know that the creature, we are told here that it will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. And it says that the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who has subject the same in hope. What does it mean to let go and let God? In the first place, you must have your feet upon the spiritual path. You cannot let go and let God unless you are conscious of the fact that God exists, that he is the supreme being of the universe, that he is omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. You must have faith in him. Now, when you put your feet upon the spiritual path, you many times, as we have talked about before, choose one of the orthodox faiths in which to start your worship of God. Now, this is not always true because, you see, we fail to take into account the fact of reincarnation, the fact that we have lived many lifetimes before. And that perhaps in our last incarnation or incarnations, we have come a great way on the path. And all we need is to be touched upon the shoulder and we will awaken. In other words, it is another question symbolically of Jesus touching the blind man, he who is blind to God through ignorance and sin of separation. And the eyes are opened, the soul is awakened, and the individual is ready to start where he left off. Many times the soul comes with a memory of its previous existence. It even remembers at the time of its birth, the fact that it was born, and its early childhood. There are quite a few cases on record to testify to this truth. So it is not always necessary to go into the orthodox faith, but it is the usual thing. But when the soul is ready and the time is right, but only God knows that, then he puts it into the mind, into the consciousness of the disciple, into the heart of the disciple, a great desire for knowing the truth, a great yearning to realize his oneness with God. And so at that time, the disciple is given whatever is necessary to start him on the path, to give him what he needs in that particular grade of school so that he may gain the necessary knowledge and take the necessary steps in order to realize his oneness with God. Now, what is a disciple? A disciple is one who follows a master, a creed, who follows, above all, God himself, with the desire of attaining salvation or the realization of his oneness with him. Now, when this happens in the later stages of spiritual development, when the heart yearns greatly for God, then God comes in human form to take the disciple out of the darkness into the light. And that dispeller of darkness is known by many names, but one of the names is Guru, that one who comes to take you out of the darkness into the light of God. But you are not really a disciple of God unless you follow and practice the teachings which the Guru gives. Unless you put them into practice, not only morning and evening and the time or two that you go to church and meet with the Guru or to the temple, not then alone, but that you put it into every minute of your life. You make it a working arrangement with God. You do the techniques that the Guru advises you to do. You practice the precepts and the concepts that are laid before you. And you make every effort to bend your will to the will of the Guru, not for the Guru's sake, but for your own sake, in order that you might get rid of this human ego, which is so very difficult to get rid of. There are a few disciples like that when you take the disciples as compared with the number of people in the world, and when you compare certain disciples with other disciples. But those who have really chosen a higher path, who have come to the point where they are ready to have their consciousness universalized, to get away from the narrow concepts of race, creed, and the narrow doctrines, then that one is sent to one who has experienced the truth and is in a position to teach them the truth. Now, it is a difficult path. And as Sister Yanamata says, the Guru isn't concerned about whether or not he or she keeps your goodwill, whether or not you become angry, whether or not you think that you are being abused, because they come for but one purpose, and that is to do what is necessary to get rid of the creature and to help that individual soul know what it truly is in God. Well, what does it mean to let go? It means to surrender yourself, your human ego, and all that you call your own, and lay it at the feet of God. But it means more than that. It means total acceptance of every single thing, every event, every experience, every test, every trial, every tribulation, every joy which comes into your life. You should accept it as coming from the Lord and for your highest good. You know, pain and suffering help you to expand. They provide growth. And they do what is necessary to till the soil of your soul until such time the seeds of God realization, which have been planted, can sprout up and reach toward the light. And that light is the light which is contained within your own soul. The trouble is, you see, every time you say, let go and let God, when you try to set yourself up a set of standards and to follow them, trying to make yourself into the image and likeness of God, you fail. Because you are the doer. You are constantly trying to do that which you think is necessary to make yourself appear in the image of God. And the reason it is not the right thing for you to do, you see, is that you are working. There's a great difference between letting and the word cause. And we must get back to the cause. You must let that which is already within you surface within yourself, express itself. And it isn't by what you do, although what you do is vitally necessary in the beginning. But it is what that you permit all that is encrusted upon your soul, the outer barnacles, to be cleaned off so that that which is already within you may be exposed and show the tremendous light, the tremendous power, the tremendous consciousness within yourself. There are many disciples who attempt to tell the Guru what is good for them. They spend long hours in saying, but I am like this, you must handle me like that. I met such a man in India when I was there the last time. And he was a very learned man intellectually. He had studied many of the scriptures. He had visited thousands of saints. He was very well read, very well informed, but that doesn't necessarily give you God realization. But God was working through me with this man, and so in spite of his the greatness of his intellect, I felt no hesitancy at all in pointing out certain things to him. Pardon me. And finally he became very angry with me, and he said, Mother, I want to tell you something about myself. He said, you will never get any place with me handling me this way. He said, you can only deal with me in love. I have a terrible temper. I said, oh, is that right? I said, well, rubbing my hands together, I'm going to take that temper and make it dance on the table. And I did exactly that. I didn't do as he asked me to do, but I just kept on with that temper and bedeviled it, so to speak, until it got out and it danced on the table. And finally, he had no place else to go, and he got rid of it. He actually got rid of the temper because I didn't listen to it. He was a very sweet man in many ways. I owe him much. He introduced me to a great many saints. And in other ways, he was very childlike. And in other ways, he wasn't at all developed. And he was filled with fears while thinking that he had attained great realization. He was afraid to wash his hands in a hotel room and to wipe his hands on the towel for fear he would get bacteria. I remember one time that he was eating a cucumber sandwich at tea in the afternoon up in the hotel room, and he was eating it with a spoon. And I said, for heaven's sake, why don't you eat that with your hands? He said, my hands are dirty. I said, well, go in the bathroom and wash them. And so he went in the bathroom, he washed them, he came out with them all dripping wet. And I said, why didn't you use the towel? He said, oh, for heaven's sake. And he went back and he wiped his hands, able to eat with his hands. But this is ridiculous. To say that you have God realization and you are so filled with fear. You know, we will read about some of the saints in India that couldn't touch food that was prepared by people whom they considered to be not just exactly holy, or if they weren't clean. And yet the God-realized soul, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, you see, can eat anything, even that which is on the ground that the dogs would eat. And some of the writings that Master told about once picking up some rice in order to prove that he was above all such things, and this rice had been there for quite some time, was certainly not in a fresh state, and he ate it and wasn't affected by it. And many times he would go and gather things outside and eat them, and or prepare them into dishes himself. He liked to cook, and he loved it. And so he would try it out on himself first, he said, and then if it didn't poison him, he would feed it to other people. And I remember one time that he found some leaves, and they were all silver-coated, and they were delicious when they were cooked, and he called it sea spinach. And his little bubble was terribly broken when one of the disciples told him that he'd been eating that for years, and they called that Mother Carey's chicken. So he hadn't discovered something new after all. But anyway, all of these things, you see, the guru does for the disciple's sake. And as it says in her letter there, that anyone who resents the criticism or the training of the guru is in a sorry state, because the ego is working to the point where they lose respect for the guru, they do not listen, they think they're being mistreated, and they really are in a sorry state. Whereas the guru, in everything that one does for the disciples, this is done with total love in the divine and with but one objective in mind, and that is to pick away at the coal that is surrounding the diamond of God realization, so that this individual may realize who and what they are in God, and that the flower of God realization, this thousand-petaled lotus of the brain, may open wide its petals, and that the light of God may flow all through that one. Sure, it isn't an easy path. Sure, it is difficult to take. But it doesn't make any difference. Many times the guru tests the disciple in many ways. I know that for myself, I wanted to be with the guru all the time. But I was in Seattle, he was in Los Angeles. I have seen him exactly 12 times in my life. Just 12. And yet, look at the tremendous impact that he made upon my life. So that now, God is using me to teach many others. And it is he who is teaching them, believe me, not I. But I learned one thing. I learned to commune with him in spirit, even to the point where if anything was bothering him, if he wasn't feeling well physically, immediately it seemed as though God told me, and I would pray for him. And later on, it would always be verified that what I got was right. I remember that one time when the lake shrine had been given to the master, and he was keeping everything a great secret because he wanted to spring it upon all of the people that were coming there. What a wonderful thing that God had done for him. And so the disciples who were working, getting the thing ready, called up and wanted him to come and see their efforts there, the results of their efforts. And he looked and he said, all right, tell him I'll go. But why they have to drag the body there all the time, I don't know. Because he had the power to be with them and to know what they were doing without going there, you see, in person. But this is the need of the deadly part. I too have it. And many's the time that I wish I could be with him all the time. And he made the statement to me once. He said, you know, Mildred, I wish very much that I could keep you with me here all of the time. But he said, your responsibility is in the world. But at that time, my life was really something. And I had three little children to take care of. And I was having a very difficult time in every way, financially and every way in life you could possibly imagine. So I thought he was talking about that. And it wasn't until long afterwards that I was made aware by God himself that what he was talking about was not my family responsibility in that sense, but of God's greater family and the fact that my work was not with the organization, but it was out in the world. Many times he spoke to me in parables and told me many things that I realized later because God showed me just exactly what the true meaning was of what he had said. It was wonderful to have this sort of communication with him even though I wasn't with him. And whenever I was with him, the love that he gave me, the wisdom that poured forth from him, the special attention that I got, I will never forget as long as I live, because every precious moment that I spent with him was really something. Now, I know that there are many in the group that want to be with me a lot more than they are. And this is constantly. But this body is not very strong these days, and I have tremendous responsibility on my shoulders and a tremendous lot of work to do. So I do the very best I can in 24 hours a day, and sometimes it's almost that, my working day. So I want you to have patience. I want you to realize that no matter if I don't see you, if I'm not able to spend the time with you, that still, in the spirit, I am consciously aware of you every moment, and that my love for you knows no bounds, and there isn't anything that I wouldn't do for you if the need arose. And I had God's direction to do it. But I can only do what he directs me to do. I will not do anything that anyone thinks that I should do unless I get that direction from God. So every moment of my life, I am working in accordance with that direction. Now, the disciple must learn to realize that and to accept it and to refuse to know that. You tie the hands of the guru so that they can no longer operate for you, and you will stop growing, because they may satisfy your little self, but they're certainly not going to be able to broaden and develop your God self. And after all, that is the reason you were sent to them and they to you in the first place, in order that you might grow in God, in order that you might uncover this great shining jewel within yourself. All you need to do is not to try to do the outer things, although you may do that and it is a help in the beginning, but to uncover that which you already are. Let go and let God. If you will let go of the human self and the human endeavor and that I do this and I do that and I have to have this and I have to have that kind of treatment or whatever, and just let what you really are come to the surface. Let it come up. Let go of that human self. And let God, who is already your true self, your very self, come to the surface and take charge of your life. Then believe me, your life will change and it will never be the same again. When you let go and let God, that means to surrender to him totally. I remember once when I was so terribly poor that, as I told you before, I had but one dress, one coat, one pair of stockings, and whatnot to my name. And I was lucky if I got one meal a day. And at that time, my husband and I had a piece of property. We were about to lose it because we couldn't pay the street assessments on it. I had gone out, even though I was going to have a child the next month, and tried to get work scrubbing because my husband didn't have a job and couldn't work. And I was willing to do housework. I was willing to do anything, but people wouldn't hire me. And so I was absolutely stuck. I tried everything. I couldn't borrow any more money anyplace, and so there it was. We were going to lose the property. And so I came to that point where I said to God, well, God, I've done everything I know. If it's your will that we keep this, you're going to have to do something about it. And you know, and this is the truth, that the next day I got a call over the telephone, and somebody said to me, I hear you're in trouble with your property. And I said, yes, that's true. We're about to lose it. And he said, how much money do you need to bail yourself out? I said, $500. He said, meet me at the bank in the morning and I will give it to you. Now, I had let go and let God. And how beautifully God took care of me. Another time I didn't have money enough to pay a gas bill, and our house was heated with gas. And sometimes when I was carrying a child, I was cold clear up to my shoulders, let alone my hips, because we didn't have any fuel, we didn't have hardly any food. I know what poverty is. When anybody comes and said, oh, well, you live in a lap of luxury, you don't know what it means to be poor, believe them not. I know. I was there. And all that I have now, whatever it may be God has given to me, it hasn't been something that I've gone out and bought for myself so that I may live in the lap of luxury. Anyway, I didn't have any money. I didn't know where I was going to get any. I had had to quit work because it was so close to the time when I was going to have my child. And so I was going through some of my husband's suits. He had two or three left from the days when things were a little more prosperous. And there I found the exact amount, right to the penny, that I needed to pay the debt bill in his pocket. And he hadn't had that suit on since we had been on our honeymoon. Sometimes I'd only have a quarter, and if somebody needed it, I would give it to them. And the next day, I would get a dollar. I got $1.75 one time when I gave away a quarter. So as you give, so shall you receive. And the more you give, the more you receive. And when I tell you to let go and let God, because I know it works, I mean what I say, because I've worked it all my life. And I'll tell you another story about Master that is simply beautiful to me. One time when I was in very great need of his help, I wrote him a letter. And I never felt that I should go to him with anything unless I gave him something in return. I didn't have much, but I had $3.50 to my name. So I gave him the $3, I sent him a check for that, and kept the 50 cents. And I have in my files to this day the letter which he sent me in return. And he thanked me for my very generous gift to him and asked him if I would receive this in return from him. And he sent me $6. He doubled my money. It's wonderful when you think how God works when you let him. You see, if we would get ourselves out of this negative idea and stop saying to ourselves, I can't do this, but say, I can, I will, I shall do it with God's help and through his grace. There's a mantram or a little prayer that Master gave me many, many years ago when I was in trouble once. And he said, say this constantly. Beloved indwelling presence, my part of God, you see to it for me that this problem, and name it, whatever it is taken care of in complete harmony, wisdom, and justice for the highest good of all concerned. Now, you're not asking for anything that isn't right in this prayer. And what you're asking for harms no man because you want for the highest good of all concerned. Many people pray selfishly, you see. They don't care who else has to pay the price in order that they get what they want or they feel comfortable or peaceful or happy or get a possession that they think that they have to have. They don't care. But you can't work that way because you can't get your good at the expense of someone else. You must see that it works for the highest good of all concerned and that your brother has an equal share in your good time. And if you constantly do that, if you give as you would and do as you would be done by, certainly God sends it back. Just let go and let God with everything you have in you and keep it flowing. And you will find that your coffers become so full that the more you give, the more you have to give, and that you can do his work. You can serve him and serve him and all of those that are poor and perhaps hungry and needy. All of my life I have been doing this. When I didn't have money many times, I went and charged something because God told me to go out and get something for somebody. My husband used to say to me, you can't spend money that you don't have, but I did. And God always put it back. He never failed to do it once because when he directs it, he is also going to provide whatever supply is needed, believe me. Now, is it possible to know God? We discussed this on Sunday, and it is possible to know God. You know him when you have gotten rid of the creature, which is your human ego self, and you have done what is necessary through meditation, through living the good life, through making the supreme effort in every factor of your life, every faction, I should say, of your life, every department of it, and letting go and surrendering to God, you will see Him face to face. You will come into contact with the great light of your own soul. Now, in the beginning, you start out with a belief in God, perhaps a faith in God. But this is purely belief, it is faith. And faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You have faith that such a thing exists. You have faith that the man Jesus, for instance, if you're an Orthodox Christian, was the first and only begotten Son of God, and that He alone died to save us from sin. But it says that Jesus is the Son of Man, and it said He's the firstborn of every creature. And therefore, it is Jesus, the Son of Man, and each and every one of us that has to be crucified or die on our own crosses, which are our bodies, in order that we might be saved or that we may rise above the human into the divine. And when we're willing to do that, when we have come to the point where we are willing to surrender ourselves, body, mind, soul, all of our possessions, even ourselves, and lay them at the feet of God, that we don't care, we're willing to die for Him, then the experiences start, and we are risen above the ordinary human consciousness and concepts of life. We're put through experiences which we never dreamed even existed, because we hadn't read about them, we hadn't heard about them, nobody had told us, and they're just brand new. But because we have come to the place where the eyes are ready to see and the ears are ready to hear, and the truth is ready to be revealed to us, then God in His infinite mercy lifts us up and He reveals that truth to us. But we must be ready to surrender all that we are. And then when we have actually gone through the experience, that then we discover what the difference is between belief, between faith, and between knowing. Because you can only know when you have actually experienced. So you can't know God. You can't see God until you have done what is necessary to experience Him. Don't ever say to yourself, I can't help it. This is the way I am. I can't change myself. That is totally erroneous, because God in you can do anything. To Him, all things are possible. But you speak the truth when you say, I can't do it, because the I that you are speaking of is the human self. And that human self is very limited. But that God self, that perpendicular I, the supreme I of the universe, that is the soul dweller within you, if you but knew it, that one can do anything. So when you let go and let Him do it, turn yourself over to Him completely, make every thought, every word, every action dedicated to Him, know that to Him all things are possible, then certainly your mind is reconditioned, it is reprogrammed, and you start thinking positively, and when you start thinking positively, you start living positively. And when you start thinking and living positively, and you've gone through what is necessary in order to realize who and what you are, this information comes to you just like from a straight pipeline from God every moment of your life. You are never without it. And in spite of the seeming human mistakes, you will find that everything has worked together for good, because you have loved Him. And that which perhaps seemed a mistake was a necessary event in your life in order that you might learn a lesson, or in order that you might be taken out of one place and put into some place where it is better for you. Because God does everything for our highest good. Now when we know this, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Do we just sit still with hands folded because we have learned these things? No. We put that truth into action, because we're put here on this world to act, not to go to sleep under a tree like Rip Van Winkle and wake up 100 years hence and not know that the world has passed you by, as indeed it will if you are in a state of human sleep all the time. Why do we not awake and realize who and what we are in God, and the tremendous power to bring into our lives all of the good and wonderful and beautiful things that God has designed for man, for His children? We are so lethargic. We sit around moaning in our beards, so to speak, because everything is so wrong. And yet, there is nothing wrong. everything is right. God is in his heaven and all is right with the world because every experience which comes to us, regardless of seeming appearance, is but for the purpose of taking you ever closer to the realization of your oneness with him. It is helping you to unveil and remove all of those layers of veils of darkness that you have put before your vision for incarnations and centuries. Everything happens for your highest good, regardless of seeming appearance. But your attitude is the important thing. Attitudes I speak of a lot, because you can accept everything as coming from the Lord with good grace, and know that he's doing it for your highest good, and you can grow, and you can be happy in spite of it. Or you can reject it and feel that you're abused, you're put upon, you're all of this and that and the other thing, and you can make yourself the most miserable creature in the world. You will affect your health, you will affect your emotions, you will affect your ability to live a normal, happy, joyful life. The secret of living is to accept everything as a challenge to be overcome. It's a tremendous adventure. It's a testing of the metal of your whole mind, of your emotions, of your physical body, of every part of you. And to me, that challenge is tremendous. I'm a fighter. I like a challenge. And I like to play the game. And I like to win the game. I always play to win. Always. I'm a good loser if I lose, because it's only a game after all. But I always play to win. So anybody that plays the game with me knows that, believe me. Because I put everything I have in it. And that's what we have to do. We have to put everything into the game of life if we're going to win. And we can win. We don't have to be people that are crawling along the earth like worms. We don't have to be stepped upon. Remember the story that is, that's been told many times. So many people think that in order to be a God person that you have to accept every God blessed thing that comes to you and never open your mouth, you know, the 7 times 70. But there's always that 7 times 7 is 49. It's 491st time where you can, reach up and make yourself felt a little bit. But the story of the snake, remember, that was going around biting everybody in the village. And the villagers were all incensed about it, and he even, of course, killed some of the people through the snake bite. And the villagers rose up in arms. Finally, a snake, saint came walking through the village one day, and the villagers gathered around him and complained bitterly because all of their people were being bitten by the snake. So the saint agreed to go and have a conversation with the snake. So he sought him out, and he said, "My brother, what is this that you do to my children?" He said, "You are biting them." He said, "You have caused the death of some of them." He said, "This is very wrong. Now you must promise me that you will never bite them again." So the snake was duly chastised, and he promised the saint that he would never bite them again. So the saint went on his way, and the snake kept his promise. And so about a year later, the saint came back, and he saw the villagers, and they were all very happy, and nothing had happened to them during the year except the natural acts of God. And so he thought to inquire about his old friend the snake. And they said, "Oh, you will find him over in a rock in yonder place." And so he went to search him out. So he came across the snake, and there he was, all bleeding and bandaged up, and he was a sorry sight. And the saint said to him, "Oh, my son, what has happened to you?" And he said, "Well, you told me that I wasn't to bite the villagers, and now that I no longer bite them," he said, "they throw sticks and stones at me," and he said, "they caused me to be like this. You see how wounded I am." And the saint looked at him and said, "Yes, my son," he said, "it is true I told you not to bite the villagers, but I didn't tell you you couldn't hit." So once in a while, it pays to hit a little. You know, because we are on the path to God, because we are God realized, doesn't mean that we have to be a doormat. Once in a while, we can hit a little. And I'll tell you something else, you see. You don't do people a service all the time if you don't hit a little bit once in a while, because you let them get away with murder. They give poor service, they give poor quality merchandise, they give you a lot of lip service, which you don't need, and all the rest of it. And you don't keep their respect, and they don't keep their self-respect unless you put them in their place and make them know that they have a job to do too, and it is also their responsibility to measure up. So unless you point that out gently in the beginning and more firmly later if necessary, you do them a disservice. You see? There is something else on the other side of the coin of this turning the other cheek, you know, 7 times 72, because it has a head and a tail. Well, you can either turn tail and run, as it says, or me and head on. Now, the greatest thing that you do in communing with God is to pray and to meditate. But there are many forms of prayer and many forms of meditation. And there are many paths of yoga. And one path is karma yoga, which is to act and react. And so you can be meditating upon God every moment of your life in everything that you do, whether it be working, playing, resting, sleeping, or whatever. If your attention is on God, if you are dedicating all thoughts, all words, all actions to Him, serving Him in everything that you do, and realizing at the same time that it is He who is doing all things through you and for you, this is a tremendous form of meditation, and it is one of the great paths of yoga. Now, there are the other paths, and we teach you a few simple techniques in order that you may keep your concentration, your attention upon God. And many of the people, I hear from people who were given Kriya the last couple of years, and especially this last time we had a tremendous group. We had 150 people who took this Kriya. And I received letters from many of the outsiders, and many of you here have written me and have told me what tremendous results you are getting. It really works. And believe me, it facilitates your getting to God in a hurry. So people, the disciples who make the effort, who are totally dedicated, who mean what they say when they say they want God realization, bend every effort. They come and sit at the feet of the Guru. They practice the techniques that are taught them. They take the truth that is taught to them, and they apply it in their everyday life. They live it. They come together. They serve God and their fellow men. And they serve with love, not hate. They're not constantly gossiping and picking one another apart. But I hear so many saying, oh, this soul is so wonderful. That one is so sweet, so beautiful, and so filled with God. And believe me, that is music to my ears. Because the harder you work, the harder you try, the faster you're going to get there. I can do everything in the world, turn myself upside down, trying to take you to the realization of your oneness with God. But unless I have your full cooperation, unless you do the work that is necessary, you will never receive your God realization, believe me. Because I don't have the magic wand that will reach out and touch you on the shoulder and say, I give you God realization without your making any effort. Because it doesn't work that way. God realization is a pearl of great price. That means the total transformation of the human or the creature in you, that which is animalistic in nature, into the divine. And it is not an easy process. And you've got to be willing to take everything with humility. That means not, as the sister said, of being a worm on the ground. It doesn't mean that at all, but it means approaching that which is necessary to take you to your God realization with a heart that is humble. It knows that of itself it can do nothing, that it is the Father who doeth the works. And it tries with everything in it, with deep humility, to take itself to God. But you see, the difficulty is, and let me point this out again, is that you try to do it. This is the little I, trying and trying and trying. And it is said that man must make every effort until he comes to the point where he knows that any effort he makes is of no avail. When he knows that he of himself knows nothing and can do nothing, then God steps in and does the work. But if you would just relax and be, learn to roll with it. You know, things that bug you now wouldn't be nearly as bad as they seem. If you could roll with it and accept it, Lord, let my attention be forever fixed upon thee. Let me love thee, let me serve thee, let me worship thee alone. Thou art all in all in all. See God in your work. See God in the people you work with and for, because He is there. And sometimes the ones that give you the worst time are your greatest friends. in reality, because they are teaching you and helping you to measure up, and you fight it every inch of the way. You do not see God in that one. You only have a personal animosity, resentment of what you think they are doing to you, where actually they are helping you to grow, to become something bigger and better than what you were, and they are helping you to the final goal, which is your God realization. So your attitude is most important. You will see people who can go through anything in life, and they have a sunny disposition. And everybody loves to be around them because they're happy people. And you don't hear them always talking, gossiping about somebody else and what the other fellow does. But they see good. They see God in everyone. And because they see God and good in their fellow man, then their fellow men see that same thing in them. And you will hear many people, oh, that's a wonderful person. It's a delight to be around him or her, whichever the case might be. And you know, they may not set the world on fire, but there's one thing you got to give them. They're giving their job everything they have. And that's the way it should be. If we would learn to see the good in every experience which comes to us, in every individual which comes before us, and know that God is there, and that whatever comes forth of that one is his will for us at the moment, and accept it. And with all, not with regret, not with resentment, but with joy, then we would really arrive. Really arrive. I would like to ask each and every one of you to let go and let God, to be able to accept everything which comes to you in good faith, knowing that this is your gift from the Father. And that which seems, perhaps, not to be such a good gift at the moment will turn out to be the greatest, most shining jewel of all. As I look back over my life, and believe me, I've had some kind of life, the very toughest times in my life I see now as the greatest gifts that God could have given me. Because whatever they were, no matter how difficult they were, no matter how difficult the people were that I had to deal with, this was the greatest experience that I could have had, because it finally took me to the point where I had no place else to go but to God. And when I came to that point, then God, through his infinite mercy, lifted me up and put me through the experiences which were necessary in order that I might know that I and my Father are one. In everything that I say, in everything that I do, I want you to know of my sincerity in trying to help you to realize what in truth you are, to become the greatest of which you are capable of becoming. And I want you to know that no matter whether I see you frequently or not, although I see you twice a week, but I mean on a personal basis, still you are always forever in my heart, and that the love of God from this forum goes forth to each and every one of you. And I am many times aware, whenever God shows me, of many of the things that you think, you feel, the things that you're going through, and I pray for you. You don't always have to tell me. I know, and I pray for you. But I don't always have to tell you that I know, because I tell you only that which God permits me to tell you, you see. But it has been proven many times that God works this way, and he comes out right on the button with the truth. It's amazing. And I sit in the midst of this forum in awe and wonder and watch his works. Believe me, I know that of myself I am nothing and can do nothing, that it is my Father who does the work. But what a privilege it is when each of us come to the point where we can be God's servant. But don't forget that until you can become a true servant of God, you must first change yourself, because the blind cannot lead the blind. So if you want to be God's servant, if you want him to use you in order to uplift and to help humanity, which I'm sure each and every one of you do, and each one will do it in his own way, with his own gifts put into practice, then you will realize what this is all about. And you will have such a sense of fulfillment, of satisfaction, and the beauty and the joy of living. And you will feel the blissful presence of the Christ within yourself, guiding you, directing you, out of the darkness into the light every moment of your life. Let go and let God. Those are the greatest words that can ever be said to any human being. And I say them to you, knowing that each and every one of you want God with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. and that you will do everything that is necessary to attain that high goal.